It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Mike Arnold, filling in today for Rob Ferret. Coming up later in the program, we'll find out why demand for European caviar might be putting pressure on Great Lakes ecosystems.
First, the White House introduced a new initiative this week aimed at combating heroin use in certain parts of the United States. The plan, which is being rolled out in 15 states, looks to improve the government's response to the drug, as well as shift the emphasis from punishment of users to the treatment of addicts.
This plan comes at a time when heroin use appears to be surging across the nation. A recent study by the Center for Disease Control and Prevention found that heroin-related deaths nearly quadrupled between 2002 and 2013. While Wisconsin is not one of the states included in this plan, heroin has certainly had an impact here. According to the State Department of Justice, the number of heroin cases processed by the Wisconsin State Crime Lab has steadily increased in almost every Wisconsin county over the last 3 years.
Joining us now to talk more about that plan is Mark Fisher. He's a senior editor at the Washington Post, where he's been writing about the heroin epidemic. Mark, thanks a lot for joining us.
Great to be with you.
Well, Mark, how big a shift is the new plan in terms of how the problem of heroin is currently being approached by the government and law enforcement?
You know, it's not a huge amount of money. It's just $2.5 million, which, as government programs go, is a drop in the bucket. But it is an important shift in terms of how the government sees the heroin problem. There's an emerging political consensus from Republicans and Democrats that the war on drugs, the idea that you can solve this by incarcerating people, has been a failure, and that some sort of conglomeration of law enforcement and public health needs to be the centerpiece of any approach to combating this heroin epidemic. And that's what they're trying to do with this initiative.
What can a partnership between public health and law enforcement do that isn't already being done right now?
Well, it starts in a kind of boring way with data analysis. One of the big problems that police and DEA officers talk about is that it takes a long time for the government under current rules and regulations to get the information about where heroin is coming from, where it's appearing, where it's causing a whole lot of overdoses. To get that information together can take a year or more, and the way it works now. Under this initiative, the idea is that they will collect this data and transmit it across state lines immediately. And so if someone from New York is shipping heroin up to Maine or Vermont and it's causing a rash of overdoses and deaths there, the various authorities in each of those states would know about it immediately and be able to act. And that acting takes place of both police action in terms of going after the distributors, but also a public health element in terms of notifying addicts that there might be a fentanyl-laced heroin, which is 30 to 50 times more powerful than most heroin and causes a lot of the overdoses, that might be reaching a particular community. So there are elements of both public health and law enforcement that could benefit from that information sharing.
So it sounds like essentially what you're describing is an increased reaction time, mobility.
Yeah, that's a big piece of it. And then the other element is that they will be training first responders, both police and fire rescue, to recognize what an overdose looks like and to respond to it with a drug that is used to reverse the effects of an opioid overdose. And that drug, Narcan, is being distributed in more and more localities around the country to first responders. But in order for them to use it effectively, they have to recognize what a heroin overdose looks like. And part of this program will increase the training in that regard.
The heroin epidemic has been, it's been around for a while. Why is it that first responders are still not familiar with what it looks like when they come across it?
Well, the epidemic has really picked up steam over the last 12 to 18 months. Obviously, heroin's been around for many decades, and it goes through periods every couple of decades of resurgence. This particular resurgence is hitting communities that have not had previous experience with heroin. You know, the stereotype of heroin is that it's an inner-city junkie drug. That stereotype was never entirely true, but it's especially not true in this particular epidemic where we're seeing heroin hitting suburban areas and rural areas where the drug was not, where first responders as well as everyone else were not familiar with the drug and what overdoses look like.
Now, this plan is being rolled out in 15 states across the Northeast only. Why focus on that area of the country?
You know, the drug policy office of the White House has an annual competition where they ask people in the various enforcement task forces across the country to come up with new ideas and new efforts. And this one was proposed by the New York, New Jersey Drug Task Force. So they found that a lot of the distributors of heroin through their region were starting in places like New York, Boston, Philadelphia, and sending the drug out through couriers to smaller communities throughout New England and the northeastern states. So that's the particular area that proposed this. If the program goes well over its first year, the hope is that it would be expanded across the country to other regions that are suffering from this heroin epidemic.
We're talking with Mark Fisher right now, senior editor at The Washington Post. We're talking about a new White House plan aimed at fighting heroin throughout the country, beginning with 15 states. And Mark, you said that this is something of like a drop in the bucket, $2.5 million here. And when you consider that in contrast to some other things, the Obama administration proposing $133 million in new spending to curb overprescription of opioids, is there a sense here that heroin is not getting the funding that it needs?
Well, you know, there is certainly a disconnect between the sort of emerging consensus that heroin needs to be addressed and that the way to address it is through providing more treatment for addicts rather than simply dumping people in prison. So that consensus is really coming to the fore in many parts of the country and across party lines. But we've not yet seen the commensurate increase in treatment beds, that is, in money for treatment facilities. So, you know, this is the age-old story. It's one thing to rhetorically support a policy. It's another thing entirely to come up with new dollars for it. And so that has been the sticking point so far in many parts of the country, where it's actually often the case for people who don't have health insurance that the only way they can get rehab treatment for their heroin addiction is to be arrested and put in jail.
So given that this is $2.5 million, only 15 states, would you consider this maybe as more of a pilot program, and then if it works, it'll be replicated somewhere else?
That's exactly what the government is saying, that it is a pilot program and that they hope to expand it. But it is a rather small program, and it's not exactly clear how quickly they can gear up to even determine whether it is working. So it's by no means a cure-all, but it is at least a signifier that there is some recognition now that addicts need to be given treatment, and that treating addiction is actually significantly cheaper for the taxpayer than putting people in prison. It's often as little as a third as much money to do that rather than to incarcerate someone.
So looking at the state level, how are states doing in laws addressing the heroin issue on that local level?
You know, the states are all over the board. About half of the states, 26 to be precise, have passed laws that make it easier for first responders and others to use Narcan to reverse the effects of overdoses. And a number of those states have also passed Good Samaritan laws, which allow someone to call for help for an addict, for someone who's overdosing, without running the risk themselves of being arrested for their own drug use or their own involvement in being in a place where heroin is being used. So there are some things that state legislatures are doing, but there are a number of states around the country where a lot of the sort of best practices on dealing with heroin addiction are not being followed because of battles over what the right kind of treatment is, whether to treat with other opioids such as methadone or Suboxone, or whether to support the drug-free kind of rehabilitation, which some say is more effective, but which is more expensive and takes a longer time.
So, Mark, if this program is successful, can you paint a picture for us about the difference that people might see in their lives, people who are affected by the heroin epidemic?
Well, if you talk to addicts and to people who run needle exchanges and rehab programs and detox centers around the country, they'll say that part of what's missing is this coordination that this program would create, this idea that law enforcement and public health could work together rather than at odds with each other, this idea that we're seeing increasingly from a number of prosecutors' offices around the country that they don't want to channel people into prisons but rather want to get them into treatment. A lot of the people in the treatment world want more of that from law enforcement, and they're seeing in this initiative at least a sign of some movement in that direction.
Mark, thank you so much for joining us.
Anytime. Thanks for having me on.
That was Mark Fisher, senior editor for The Washington Post. He joined us to talk about the new White House plan aimed at fighting heroin throughout the country. For many years, Lake Superior has had an advantage over other Great Lakes because its native fish populations were remarkably stable.
But more recently, a key part of the Lake Superior food web is in trouble, and that could have some far-reaching consequences.
Joining us to talk about lake herring is Mark Vinson. He's a fisheries biologist with the U.S. Geological Survey and station chief of the Lake Superior Biological Station. Mark, thanks a lot for joining us.
You're very welcome. Nice to be here.
Well, let's talk a little bit about lake herring. What is this fish and where is it found?
It's found throughout the circumpolar region of the globe, so in Scandinavia, in Russia, the northern part of the United States and Canada, and it's a freshwater fish in pretty much all large lakes.
And is it in all of the Great Lakes?
Historically, it was in all the Great Lakes. It was the most abundant fish in all the Great Lakes at the turn of the century. That's the 19th and 20th century. Now it is found primarily in Lake Superior. There are small populations in Lake Huron and Lake Ontario, Michigan, and perhaps even a small remnant population in Lake Erie.
So why should we be concerned about lake herrings right now?
It's a delicious fish, for one reason. It's also plays a huge role in the food web, so are the ecosystem functioning of these large lakes and how it moves energy from offshore region. It's a zooplankton eater, and then it converts that into flesh, and then it, in turn, is consumed by lake trout. So it fuels the lake trout population, and which is the primary predator within Lake Superior.
So if you take the lake herring out, then the trout doesn't have anything to eat, and everything goes to heck, right?
Somewhat, yeah, that's true. And the other thing that it does is it spawns in the fall with huge spawning aggregations, and it lays a tremendous amount of eggs in nearshore areas. And then throughout the winter time, when the lake is typically ice-covered, those eggs are consumed by lots of other species that live in the lake. So it provides food for them throughout the winter when other food is not as readily available.
Well, there's another fish alone that like the eggs of the lake herring. It sounds like Europeans have developed quite a fondness for the caviar, too. Why is that, and when did that start?
Historically, it probably started for the Scandinavians, way back in time. They weren't eating fish caviar from North America until about 2003 it started, and then it ramped up in about 2007. 10, 12, 13, and it's declined since 2013. And the reason they turned to North American caviar, in particular caviar from Lake Superior, was because of its quality, and their fisheries for Vendus, which is an equivalent lake herring Cisco species in Europe, their populations were down during that time.
So basically, it's shifted to us.
Correct. They were looking for a source for this caviar, and Lake Superior could provide that source.
Now, have lake herring been popular, or what have they traditionally been used for?
Their popularity has gone up and down throughout the Great Lakes in terms of table fare. So in the turn of the century, like I said previously, they were tremendously popular as table fare. And then that declined about in the 1930s, and they were primarily used, from Lake Superior, as food for mink. And then their popularity in recent years has increased again as table fare. One reason is they're so abundant, and they are delicious. So, Minnesota Sea Grant has really promoted use of lake herring or Cisco as table fare.
So, have they been too successful?
I don't think so. Not there's still not a huge market for the actual fillets. The market right now is primarily with the roe in the fall.
And so it sounds as though the spawning of the herring is one area of concern. What do you see there that we might be needing to think a little bit about?
Yeah, and I think that's more of an issue in terms of why we're concerned about population declines is recruitment. And recruitment means that, for a fish to be able to survive to age one or even age two. And we haven't seen recruitment events since, strong events, since the 1990s. And so right now the fishery is living off a pretty big recruitment event in 2003 and a much smaller event in 2009.
I'm sorry, what's a recruitment event again?
A recruitment event is fish are recruited to a population, and they're considered to be recruited when they're at age one or two. And so we have lots of spawning that's occurred because we have high populations in Lake Superior, but we don't get survival of these fish to age one or age two, to age one.
So why aren't they surviving?
That's the big question right now, and that's what we spend a lot of our time in our office and a consortium of agencies across Lake Superior trying to figure that out. We don't know why that is.
So it's not entirely based on the fact that everybody loves caviar in Europe.
No, the recruitment issue has nothing to do with harvest of the adults. It just has to do with survival of the young fish.
But given that there is this market for caviar and the recruitments are not happening, does that mean together that could form a sort of perfect storm?
Yeah, that's something you don't like to see. I mean, even if there was no fishing at all, though, you would eventually run out of adults if you didn't have any young being produced. So this fish lives to 20 years, and it's in its nature to have variable recruitment, so not to pull off a good year class every year, but it seems like it's gone a little bit too far lately.
So what are you learning from watching the situation that can be applied to fisheries management as a whole?
One thing is that climate change seems to play a role in it. So if we don't get good ice cover on Lake Superior, then that means we're not going to have a good year class. And so that's what we saw kind of through the middle 2000s when we saw poor ice cover, pretty much starting after 1998.
Oh, okay.
Now, at present, we've had good ice cover, and we think we've had a couple recruitment events last year and also this year.
Mark, thank you so much for joining us.
Mark Vinson is a fisheries biologist with the U.S. Geological Survey and station chief of the Lake Superior Biological Station.
As summer winds down, kids across the country are enjoying their last weeks or so of freedom before the school year starts up again. When it does, it means a return to classes, teachers, and what every student seemingly dreads the most, homework. But one question that comes up from time to time is how much homework is too much?
Well, a recent study found students in the early elementary school years are getting significantly more homework and spending more time on it than is currently recommended by education leaders. But how is it determined how much homework is the right amount? And is homework actually a good tool when it comes to learning?
Joining us now is Steve Correa. He's a former professor of education at St. Norbert College. He's now directing assessment of learning effectiveness for a series of charter schools in Minnesota. Steve, welcome back.
Oh, glad to be here, and good afternoon.
Well, let's start with the results of the survey. What did it find about just how much homework young kids are getting right now?
Well, it seems that apparently about 1,000 parents were surveyed, and we all have to kind of assume that it was done statistically correct. And what they determined was that, I guess, somehow in the early primary grades and then approaching about sixth grade, seems that kids had perhaps somewhere between 30 to 45 to 50 minutes of homework a night. And that has upset people on a variety of levels. In fact, if any of the listeners Google too much homework under the news section, you'll get over 500,000 hits. So it's obvious that this was a popular topic for news outlets in addition to WPR.
Well, it seems as though the general perception is that there's more of it than there used to be. Do you have any idea whether that's true or false?
I think that a lot of people associate homework with rigor and challenge and difficulty. and value. And those are really false assumptions, because they don't automatically mean that. But to an uncritical eye, I think that people naturally think, well, my child has homework, they spend a lot of time, that's a good thing. My child doesn't have homework, or my child doesn't spend much time on homework, and that's a bad thing. And so I think that with days of No Child Left Behind, and you know, we can't be soft on education anymore, homework is perceived as one of those value-added activities. And so therefore then, some parents just naturally expect it, and or you want it. And so sometimes teachers willingly oblige because, gee, you're supposed to do this.
Well, just to give us an idea what some of the pros involved here think, the National Education Association and the National Parent Teacher Association, they subscribe to what's called the 10-minute rule. And that means 10 minutes of homework per grade level. So if you're a first grader, you get 10 minutes, second graders have 20 minutes, and all the way up through high school. What do you think about that method?
Well, I guess, gee, it kind of belies my age a little bit. I've been in education over 30 years, advanced degrees, all those other kind of things. That can be both good and bad. I have never heard one study in my life that equates time spent with homework equals a value derived from that homework. So this is a mythology that somehow we are warming up first graders with 10 minutes of homework, and by the time you're in sixth grade, you'll be ready for 60 minutes of homework. It's not a track meet, and it's not like stretching our hamstring muscles, but this perception persists that we have to get them used to it younger, and then later they'll be able to do it. You know, by the same logic, we would be having them work at Target or Walmart for 10 minutes when they were 5 years old. By the time they turn 21, they'll be able to work an eight-hour day. It's just false, but it persists. This study showed that while one may or may not value that 10-minute rule, it seems that most places are far in excess of that, and that's because it's impossible to be able to in any way determine for a random group of 25 first graders how long 10 minutes or how long their homework is going to take. You have 25 individuals. They process differently. They think differently. They access differently. And so, you know, it's based on a lot of misperceptions and false ideas and mythology. So it's no wonder that the outcomes are unsatisfactory. It's because the inputs are really wrong-headed.
We're talking with education analyst Steve Correa about homework. A new study suggests that kids in their early elementary years are getting too much homework. Our guess is maybe we should be thinking about it as a quality issue when it comes to homework and not a quantity issue. And Steve, you use the words warm up. Isn't there some truth to that, though, that if kids find themselves in high school and they're not used to doing homework, that it's like an endurance athlete, that they don't have the chops to get through it and the willpower it takes to successfully complete it if they don't get used to it earlier on?
Yeah, you know, it's there used to be this idea in psychology well over 100 years ago called mental faculties. And we thought of the brain as kind of like a muscle. And, you know, it's like, well, okay, we're in calculus class, but let's warm up with addition and subtraction first. So obviously we don't do that. But this idea of encouraging students to see how learning activities connect is valuable. Boy, there's not a teacher listening or alive that does not want to see their students make strong connections between reading, writing, critical thinking, and analyzing something with the idea that they're excited about learning. But if one invests that in homework alone, there are better ways to build character and determination and perseverance and focus than giving a kid worksheets or those kind of things.
Okay, what do you recommend instead of homework?
Well, and again, homework might be appropriate. We have homework for, if you sort of think of it as two ways, there's skills-based homework. Sometimes students need to be able to practice times tables, or sometimes they need to be able to, perhaps beyond third grade, understand some rules of spelling. Oh, it might be anything for how to draw shapes. Could be a number of skills-based things. Remember taking, did anybody take typing or playing your musical instrument? You know, so that's skills. That takes time, and there's a good argument that can be made for that in a thoughtful kind of way. But we monitor the student's progress, and it's not as if 30 minutes a day will magically turn you into a Yitzhak Perlman. We have to be able to focus and direct. Now, we can also have content-based homework, where you need to be able to read the chapter, you need to be able to understand what we're talking about, you need, you know, the character of the play, who's Atticus Finch, I mean, whatever the case it might be. And then we review and we make connections with those things. But to look at it just with time, it's, and the reason they go with time, they don't know what else to do. It's such a, it's an easy kind of a hook and a measure, but it could be both inadequate and it can be overburdened. So it's really looking at it the wrong way.
And from time to time, we see stories about kids who are stressed out. They have mental health issues. Does too much homework play a role in that, or can it?
Oh, definitely. And, you know, now that's a larger function of a child probably not enjoying school, not finding connections, not finding themselves a member of that school community, not identifying anything positive with that. So I wouldn't say homework was the cause of the anxiety, but it certainly can heighten it, make it much more unpleasant. Usually homework won't send someone over the edge, so to speak. They were there long before that. But the problem is, a lot of times, and anybody listening to this, boy, they're going to just, everyone's going to agree with this. They're going to remember that homework assignment. Why did I do that? I never even got it back from the teacher. Now, sometimes you do it if we want to develop this sense of intrinsic benefit to learning. Those are good things. You make the connections. But usually that's something that happens over time, and teachers try to incubate that. But if it's this idea that you just do it and it's going to build character and it's going to make you strong and a great student, no, magic doesn't happen like that.
And I mean, you do hear that from parents themselves when this debate comes up amongst parents, that life is made of stuff that you don't want to do a lot of the time. You just have to muscle through it because it's what you do. You're a grown up, and isn't, in a way, homework practice for that?
No. No. You know, and really what you're talking about right there, you're talking about focus, maturity. You're talking about respect for authority. You're talking about an understanding of how things connect. You're talking about understanding the role of background information, a lot of other things. But to invest all of that in homework, that's just, boy, that's a lot of pressure on the homework industry, isn't it? It just doesn't work that way. There's better ways to do that. Kids can, that's why maybe there's chores at home, there's learning activities, there's being parts of groups, there's social responsibility for other people, there's taking care of pets and neighbors, there's shoveling. I mean, all these other kind of things. But if one thinks that this is derived solely from homework, then I think we have a similar response to Tevye in Fiddler on the Roof. You know, that's tradition. And much of what goes on in schools, for better or worse, is tradition.
We're talking right now with education analyst Steve Correa about homework. A new study suggests that kids in early elementary education are getting too much homework. Our guest says it's not so much a quantity problem as a quality problem.
You can join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. more. What do you think about your child's homework load? Are you concerned more about how much homework they're getting or what the homework actually is? Or maybe you're a teacher and you think it's perfectly fine to send kids home with homework. More broadly, what do you think homework really matters? Excuse me, give me a call. Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Dime Facebook page. We're talking with education analyst Steve Correa about homework. As back to school draws closer and closer, homework is on the minds of students and teachers alike. But how much is too much?
And we're taking your calls right now at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the amount of homework your child has in the grade level they're about to go in, or maybe the one they were in? What about the content of that homework? Is it doing the job, teaching important things? Are you happy with the amount? Do you want to see your child coming home with homework? Anything you think could be done to improve it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. And Steve, when it comes to homework policies, how much of it is set by teachers and how much would you say is set by districts or other expectations, maybe nationally?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think because in the last few years, and in fact, I had a psychology class I taught last year that was involved in this. We did a survey. We just got online and looked at some of the larger districts around the United States and even some smaller ones. We hit all 50 states. If there is an official policy, it's almost always based on time. And almost every district has a policy for homework, and I think because this has become increasingly central to the issue of learning in school and helping students to do better, that idea. And so districts are trying to get out in front of it to be able to say they have a policy. Most of the time, then, that's where the discussion sort of stops. Parents will say, oh, okay, well, then it's based on, you know, the national PTA or whatever. What parents should be doing is saying, well, you should ask your school board, well, where did they get their information? What did they base it on? So, you know, it's as if going to the doctor when your child is ill, well, 1,000 other students took this medicine, so it must be okay for your child. Take it for 7 days and they'll be better. Well, that's, you know, most parents are going to say, wait a minute, my child doesn't weigh as much, weighs more, has these other conditions, has these other circumstances. So it's not one size fits all. And that's what parents need to do. You not only want to hold the school board accountable, you want to know what they're basing their decisions on. And you should be asking teachers those exact same things, too.
Let's go to our callers now. We've got Eileen with us from Madison. Hi, Eileen.
Hi.
What do you think?
I think kids have too much homework. I just think that if you worked all day at work and then you brought your work home with you and you worked at night, people would call you a workaholic. And they would tell you you don't have work-life balance. And I think it's very important that kids have family time and free time and creative time. I just don't think every moment scheduled is good for kids.
Interesting analogy, Eileen. Thanks for that. And Steve, what do you think of that? That your kids are at school, kind of like going to your job, like work, and then they go home and they do more work.
Right. I suspect Eileen has perhaps read Alfie Kohn's book on the homework myth, and that's much the argument that Kohn articulates. He said, you know, as adults, while every once in a while we might take homework, if we did that every day, we would probably have some social adjustment issues, and those around us wouldn't like it. So an 8-hour day should more or less handle what that student needs to do. And so she makes a really good point. Now, sometimes, and perhaps some of the listeners even remember this, we got excited about a project. We really jumped into it, and whether it was building something, making something, researching something, going somewhere, you know, video, audio, oh, and we didn't even care about the time. We didn't even look at the time. And those are the things that's why people get into education, because your child, you're saying children are excited about learning. And as a parent, oh, but you can see, it's almost, can you imagine, okay, you will be excited for 20 minutes tomorrow to do your homework. It's second grade. Well, we don't do that. So I think Eileen's really spot on with this, that, you know, it's children spend all day in school, and to expect schools to not only teach content and skills, but these large amounts of character and perseverance issues, this is where families and communities come involved. And to invest all this in homework, again, it's really having a lot of confidence in homework that is not properly placed there.
We're talking with former professor of education, Steve Correa. He's joining us to talk about the issue of homework. Lots of parents in a new study saying kids have too much of it, especially in elementary education. And we want to know what you think at 800-642-1234. Is homework good for building perseverance, grit, determination, or is it something that is just given for the sake of homework? Let us know, 800-642-1234. And we go next to Stephanie in Madison. Hi, Stephanie.
Hi there. I just want to say, you know, homework for us, we have two parents working, and by the time you get home at night and make dinner, you know, doing homework is eating up a lot of our precious family time. And in addition to that, you know, I have two elementary school students, and there's a lot of homework battles every night where maybe 20 minutes turns into an hour just or more based on the battles that go along with that. And, you know, I do understand things like having, you know, reading assignments, things that maybe you can do together as a family or at least have a discussion about as a family as opposed to worksheet after worksheet. That really just becomes a nighttime battle where you're exhausted.
Okay, well, thank you so much for telling us about your story, Stephanie. Stephanie describing something a lot of parents understand, the battle over homework, getting kids to do it. I mean, no matter what side you're on, that battle can happen. What do you think about those dynamics?
Oh, gosh. You know, I was thinking anybody out there that has children of an age that go to a pediatrician, a really good pediatrician has a variety of medicines that they might prescribe for your child's condition, but they will often try to prescribe the one that maybe isn't the greatest, but they'll instead go for one that will work with your family. So if you have a child that has asthma, maybe before we try a nebulizer and a whole series of other things, we'll try some other medications that are easier, that work for the family better, and that perhaps don't require one to go into a doctor's office to give it or those kind of things. And really what Stephanie's talking about is it's this idea of how does that homework impact the family, the setting, the support? Because can you imagine coming home from work every day and having to spend an hour every night hating the work that you're doing? And your reward is the next day you get to go back to work. Well, let me tell you, that's not teaching you perseverance. That's teaching you that you're making negative assumptions, you're not happy about what you're doing, and no one's helping you to be excited about learning. And that's what we want to have happen. So, yeah, Stephanie's situation there, that's a common one.
Let's get to another caller here. Kim joins us next in Fort Atkinson. Hi, Kim.
Hi.
What do you think?
I'm an educator, and we call it suggestive learning practice. It is important that students do practice outside of the classroom. In my classroom, I do a lot sometime. Some kids don't take advantage of the time that I give them to practice what they're learning. And it's just like anything. If you think about a sport, you have time on the field that you have to practice, and then you have the game time. So students outside of the school curriculum, when they're not practicing with the team, they're out practicing at home, and the only way you're going to get better is to practice.
Kim, appreciate that, the perspective there of an educator. And Steve, briefly, what do you make of that argument that kids do need to practice? Doesn't always happen in the classroom. It's something that needs to be built sometimes during the off hours.
Oh, sure, and that would make sense. And again, since we've used the sport analogy, are we talking speed? Are we talking reaction time? You know, we break this down into the sum of its parts, and then the learner or the athlete understands the sum of those parts and understands how they fit together. Quite frankly, a lot of students have no clue how this fits together, nor do the parents. And so teachers, really good teachers, will help them all to be able to see those connections, refer to those connections, make sure everybody knows those connections, and do that on a consistent basis. And then you'll find a lot of success. But homework for homework's sake is no better than arguing that daylight savings time is a good idea, because you're not going to find much evidence to support that.
Steve, thank you so much for joining us today.
Always very happy to be here.
That was Steve Correa, former professor of education at St. Norbert College. He's now directing assessment of learning effectiveness for a series of charter schools in Minnesota. He joined us to talk about the merits of homework as kids get ready to go back to school.